Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again with another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, kind of a final recap of spring, some additional information that we've been able to garner from that we'll share with people. Going to have a decent amount of questions that we've compiled, and just kind of a general overview of what's going on with the program as we kind of transition out of spring into summer, and just kind of take stock as to where things stand currently. So always look forward to doing this. Excited to do this on an NFL draft night. We'll certainly talk about where Derwin James was selected. Why don't we go ahead and jump right into this and put together another episode or rendition of the Nolcast.
Yeah, man. Glad to be back. Thanks to Louisiana Hot Sauce, as always, our presenting sponsor. Just sitting here watching the NFL draft with you before we hit record. Derwin James goes to the Chargers. Kind of a fun fact on that. You know, I know a lot of Bucs fans are probably pretty ticked that they didn't take him, but you know, they also needed the defensive tackle, so I can certainly see that. The defensive coordinator for the Chargers is Gus Bradley, who was the defensive coordinator in Seattle when Seattle was putting together that awesome Legion of Boom defense with Richard Sherman and Cam Chancellor and all those guys. He's got to just be like you know, out of his mind right now to thinking about how he probably got his Cam Chancellor 2.0. So pretty cool moment there for Derwin and his mom. That's pretty cool. Awesome for Derwin. Glad to see him come back from the injury. And four ACC defenders in the top 18 picks, and the Clemson guys stayed in school.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. That's pretty interesting too. As always, we're into talking season now, man. For us, it's always talking season, but for football now, it's Willie Taggart's out there doing the booster tour and talking to folks. And from, you know, what we've heard as far as feedback, it's been really good so far. Boosters are liking it. They're energized. They're coming out to hear the new message and feel like somebody is talking to them rather than talking at them. And that's a welcome change in the eyes of some. And the head coach actually showing up.
I was gonna say if he's even talking at him, yeah. Been a good session so far.
I know some people that run booster clubs, and they were not real happy the demands that the booster organization would put on them, and then he wouldn't show up, the old coach, mm-hmm. or you know, would say, okay, I'm only going to do, you know, one of those three clubs in that region this year or whatever. Yet they still want the same amount of money every time. This is one of the areas where I think it does help to have a coach who is, you know, comes from a lower division, you know, being at USF and being at Western Kentucky. Because if you skip out on the rubber chicken circuit there, you're not going to get any money at Western Kentucky or at USF.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to buy practice jerseys if you don't do that stuff at Western Kentucky. So a very good point.
So, you know, people are asking, what are they doing now? Well, the kids are finishing up some finals, and they are going to be in their off-season program, going to do, you know, 7-on-7 work, et cetera. But over the last 2 weeks, not like this week, but the last 2 weeks, basically since the spring game has been done, they've actually been going through exit interviews, and I've been digging around to find a little more out about this. But from what I can tell, and I, you know, talk with a parent here, here's who's in the exit interview. The kid, Willie Taggart. The kid's coordinator, the position coach, the strength coach, whatever strength coach assistant is in charge of that person's lifting group, and the head trainer, Jake. The reason I think why they have all those people in there is for complete accountability and so that the kid can't make excuses, right? Because it's easy mm-hmm. to blame something mm-hmm. or to make an excuse if the person who's in charge of that element of the program isn't in the room. They also have the academic advisors in there. And your personal academic advisor and the academic head. So this is a lot of people they're devoting to this, man, a whole lot of folks. And so they're looking at the kids, really breaking down every single angle of them. And they started, they asked the kid to give his evaluation of himself. Where do you think you're at, and where do you want to get? And then they'll give him feedback as far as, is that realistic to get there? Or, hey, maybe this goal you set for yourself is too low. Like, we know your ability. We're going to need you to give greater effort in this area. Here's your penalty points on the accountability board. Did you have a good you know, good semester, or did you have so many penalty points that we actually had to remove you from your accountability group because everybody else was getting tired of running and it was clear that the peer pressure wasn't working? You know, did we have to have you miss the spring game to work on academics? You know, stuff like that. So, you know, where are you at in picking a major? How's your body weight? How's your body fat? What are your strength numbers like? You know, you say you want to be a starter this year. Look, you're going to have to get this amount stronger. We're going to be real honest with you. Like, it's an open competition, but this is where the guy you're competing against is at. So we're going to, you really got to work that much harder if you want to beat him out. You know, hey, how's your rehab going? Well, guess what? You say you went to all these rehab sessions, but we got the medical staff here.
Exactly.
They say otherwise. You know, how's your class attendance? You know, is it a function of you're just not smart enough to take these classes? Do we need to get some extra help? Or is it a function of you haven't been going to class? So I was told that some of these were pretty intense, and some were, you know, less so, like for kids who are on the right track. But for some of these kids who are not on the right track, look, man, there's going to be a purge go on for sure. And that happens every time you have a new coaching staff come on. And there's going to be some kids who have got to, you know, shape up or ship out, basically. And this is the way to set the expectations that, you know, if you, later on down the road, if the kid doesn't meet them, he knows what's going to go on.
I think it's a fantastic thing. I think the number of people that are involved just speaks to the seriousness that it's taken with. And also, it, you know, if you're a college student or a college age kid, you walk into a room and all of a sudden, you know, six or seven people are sitting there. You get an idea. It's not just, you know, this is not just some kind of formality that they're trying to check off their list or anything else. It's something that I think will aid Taggart and staff significantly. And I also think it's a great kind of reminder to people who just watch YouTube videos or see something on Twitter and see like rap music being played and people jumping around and dancing and thinking that there's not a more very professional element to this staff as well. Good. Taggart is contemporary in many ways, but he's also he can be a pretty cold professional as well. And I think this is a nice, not in your face as far as like aggressive, but just face to face. Here's our expectations. Here's where we see where you are. And like you said, there's not a whole lot of ambiguity left after one of these exit interviews, from what we understand anyway.
Yeah, and ultimately, I think the kids for the most part appreciate it, and I'm sure the parents appreciate it. You know, it's good to get feedback in all areas. You know, this is sort of also part of the, hey, if you don't play, you know, there's nobody to blame but yourself. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a great point you bring up too, as far as people see the hype, people see the fun, but they don't necessarily see the seriousness. So I do hope that the listeners appreciate us letting them know, hey, these are pretty serious things that have gone on. It's not just like a quick 10-minute check-in. I mean, they took 2 weeks to do this, like 70 guys on the roster right now, because they got like 15, 16 more coming in from the incoming recruiting class. So that's pretty impressive. It was really an all-day thing. And they were in there. That's a long day of meetings. One thing, by the way, that we, you know, been discussing is where will guys line up in this defense? Well, I'm told that if you walk into the Moore Center, one guy you can find just constantly in there and just exceeding expectations, and he hasn't played a single game yet. Seems like every single time I talk to somebody over there on that staff, the coaches are just, they're wowed by him, man. It's Jaden Woodby. Like, he has just come in, and, you know, we told you, like, on his visit, he was taking notes during, like, the presentation, and that really impressed the coaches, and, like, he had questions that he'd written down, like, come into the meeting with, and he came to Tallahassee on a mission to find out, hey, man, like, can I accomplish all my hopes and dreams here, and is this going to be the right spot for me? And it seems like this guy just puts in a ridiculous amount of off-field work.
Volunteers for Habitat with Humanity as well when he's not doing that. I could go without seeing him use a power saw or anything else like that, but yeah, when you mentioned that, and when we first heard some of the reports of his official visit, I wasn't dismissive of it, but I had a decent filter of skepticism for it as well, just because and I'm not blaming this on Jimbo, because this is all coaches, but you hear a ton of hyperbole about kid, you know, oh, this class is full of great characters and this is a great kid, blah, blah, blah. It's been very, very impressive what he's done on all fronts since he's gotten on campus.
It's a maturity that you don't really see with freshmen. And he, I believe, is going to play star now, which is your like half linebacker, half safety spot, playing in the slot a lot. We saw the Kalen Brooks play a lot in spring. Look, Woodby is a much better athlete. So if you're able to get him there, if he can actually master the position, that allows you to get more athleticism and, I think, more physicality on the field. This necessarily means he's going to start, but I think he's going to play a lot as a true freshman with just the way he's come in. I think people had high expectations for him, and I think he's already exceeded as far as like for the offseason. Granted, he hadn't played a single game yet, but they seem really pleased with him, man. On that Habitat for Humanity thing,
mm-hmm.
Did you see who else was doing that?
Was that Brooks as well?
I think he might have been there, and I noticed two other guys. Zaquandre White?
Yeah. Zaquandre was the kid who I was thinking of, not Brooks. Sorry.
So, you know what? That's good. That's good to see that he's still, you know, participating in those activities and still doing stuff. You know, I still got hopes for that kid, man. I know he didn't get to play in the spring game, but still got hopes. And also Francois was there. That's good to see him doing that kind of stuff.
Good for DeAndre.
I know we've been skeptical as far as this attitude turnaround, and, you know, we'll see how long, you know, if you maintain it for a long time, eventually it becomes a habit and becomes a trait and becomes who you are. No, you know, never too late to turn it around. Can't hate on him for that. That was just good to see.
And old Odell with his broken knees and everything else out there volunteering his time as well. So anybody needs to give Odell Haggins character references at this point, but continues to be the genuine article. But one other thing I know that we wanted to mention was just kind of the general impression of kind of the physicality or strength of the overall roster. And I don't mean like position group strengths. I mean like physical strength. And this is probably a comment that I wouldn't completely dismiss if a coach made in general, but just with some of the background that we know and some of the background conversation that we've had here, I think this is, I tend to put a little bit more stock into this, but I know you noticed where Taggart talked about that as an overall roster, not exactly as strong as he thought they'd be.
We had heard this too, but this is the first time that he's actually said it publicly. So that was interesting. They definitely feel like, how do I say this? Like maybe some beach muscles, you know? Maybe some, but look, the other thing I think, and it just, when I first heard it, I was like, well, that's because you had guys skipping workouts. That was a thing. It was a known thing. We talked about it last year. The level of buy-in maybe wasn't necessarily what you needed at all times. When you're ranked number two or number three preseason in the country, people don't want to hear that. But I think that's why we're one of the better podcasts out there, maybe the best one in the FSU sphere. We say what we hear. And I do think you're going to have better buy-in. And I really think you would with any new coaching staff because that's just what change agents do. Jimbo got great buy-in when he got to Tallahassee. It's just what happens. These kids are excited. They're excited that they get a new chance. They get to be evaluated by somebody new. You know, guy like, you know, Nooney Murray being told that he had, you know, the, like the best spring before he got hurt, you know, as far as the offseason workouts. And you know, Nasir Upshur, who I don't think anybody thought was going to do anything based on his first, you know, first couple semesters in Tallahassee. Now he looks better. And having a fresh set of eyes on you can motivate you to prove yourself all over again. It's a fresh start. And I do think this team is going to get stronger than they were. That doesn't mean everybody's going to get stronger like than they were. But I do think that the floor will probably be raised up a little bit because you're going to have, I think, better attendance at these voluntary workouts over the summer.
Final thing is just the retiring of Peter Warwick's jersey. It's something that we mentioned a couple weeks ago as far as what his number being retired.
Yes, but now it looks like they're going to do it at the Virginia Tech game. A lot of people emailed us about that, and that's pretty cool.
Fitting that they'd do that against Virginia Tech.
Since he kind of retired their last real national championship chance.
Kind of put that to bed. Well, good, man. We talked about Peter a couple weeks ago when this was first announced, but as electrifying a player as there's been in college football, if you happen to be the age that Bud and I are, he's, you know, a guy that you grew up with watching and just in amazement what he could do. His performance against Clemson when he was a sophomore is probably one of the two or three best individual performances I've ever seen from a Florida State player. Nobody needs to remind Florida State fans as to how good Peter Warwick was, but just great to see that he's bestowed with that honor.
Yeah, no doubt, man, no doubt. Tonight we're going to do mostly a mailbag show, a couple of recruiting updates. Brennan Gant decommitted from Alabama. He's a safety out of Lakeland, which, by the way, there was a safety out of the Lakeland area tonight who got drafted in the first round. good chance he ends up in Florida State. Certainly, he decommitted one day after he came to FSU. Taggart and Coach Woody, the linebackers coach, were actually at the Orlando Under Armour camp where Gant had a pretty nice day. And you know who the defensive back coaches are at Under Armour, Ingram? This is something I'm not sure a lot of people know if they don't go to these.
Mm-hmm. Dion's involved, isn't he?
Dion and Corey Fuller.
Corey Fuller, that's it, yeah, yeah.
So, if you wanted to, you probably could just make a phone call or just walk over because, you know, Corey coaches at Godby.
Convenient.
You probably could just ask, hey, what you got to work these kids out, you know, what'd you think? And you also got to watch them in person. So that was something I wanted to mention. You know, they took Renardo Green's commitment, a kid out of Wekiva, which is there in Apopka. He was also a guy who was at that camp that day. And look, there's no doubt that Raymond Woody III and Willie Taggart's son being able to go to these camps, that's a benefit for Florida State. Todd Grantham's kid, by the way, is a Florida's defensive coordinator, is a linebacker. I think he's a backer. He's not like a major prospect at this point. He was actually at the Under Armour Atlanta camp, so I got to see Grantham over the weekend when I was there doing work. So anyway, it's always good to be able to see kids like that. Florida State's doing well on the recruiting trail. I don't think they're number one in the nation anymore because some other teams have landed some commitments, but it's been going good, man.
All right, bud. With that, we will jump into the questions and had a decent amount of Twitter inquiries as far as this situation in general. But the first question is, if Jalen Hurts transfers, would Florida State take him or be in the mix for him?
Okay, would they take him? Absolutely. You kidding me? I would take him in a heartbeat. Let me clarify this. Would he start for you? I'm not sure he throws the ball better than the guys you have on your roster. I know he's an incredible runner. And for all the people who say, you know, there's not a chance, I'm gonna pull up some numbers here. And let's go to cfbstats.com, which people often hear me typing in during these shows. I do recall that Willie Taggart had an offense at one point where his quarterback ran for 2,900 yards in the span of 2 years. 2,900 yards over 408 carries. That guy's name is Clinton Flowers. I have that wrong. It's not 2,900. It's 2,400. Apologies. If Jalen Hurts wanted to come to Tallahassee, yeah, they would take him. Because right now, quarterback depth-wise, they don't have a lot of it. And I'm on record. I think Blackman will be your starter unless Francois makes a big-time recovery, both physically and leadership-wise, mentally. But look, Jalen Hurts, the ceiling might be limited, but the floor on Jalen Hurts is real nice. Can he throw it up if you got a one-on-one? Can he take a pounding and you can run him 20 times a game in an offense that we know is a running offense and that will run the quarterback? Not as much as maybe like Florida's going to do, but certainly a lot more than Jimbo did. I think they would absolutely take him. Would they be in the mix? I think that's the better question here.
If not, who else do you think would be considered? Just as you were doing that, I was kind of going through. You wouldn't necessarily return to one of the major power programs from his home state, I would think. But who else do you think would be involved in Hurts?
Well, some schools that I think he would absolutely kill it at. Has an opening, does run the QB a lot. I mean, he would probably walk in there and start immediately in Maryland. How about Gainesville?
Mm-hmm.
You got two guys there who are your, like returning upperclassmen who are not really good runners. And you got a true freshman in Jones. It wouldn't be the worst thing for the Gators to get a guy who can really run, because we know that Dan Mullen runs the heck out of his quarterback. And I'll give you a third one, which is kind of close to his home state of Texas. How about Kansas State? Think about what Kansas State does with these thick quarterbacks, and they run them, 15 times a game or whatever. Imagine if that thick quarterback actually had some speed. Like, you had Colin Klein and all. Like, put Jalen Hurts on Kansas State. That would be incredible. The reason I don't think that Hurts, that Florida State would be a legit finalist for Hurts, is that I think if you're Hurts and you're transferring from somewhere because you just lost the job, you want to go somewhere where you'd be guaranteed to win the job, or pretty much guaranteed. At Florida State, there's two guys who you have to view as legitimate competition. Yeah, that was our number one asked question this week, the Jalen Hurts transfer thing. Would they take him? Yeah. Do I think he would pick FSU? Probably not, because I don't think that he would view it as a place where he would have a like a greater than 50% chance to start. And I think that'd be an accurate interpretation of his odds by him.
We're going to mix it up a little bit to have kind of questions and also spice in our buy or sell questions throughout the podcast as well. So I want to thank our friends from Resolution Home Loans. They're the people that make these buy or sell questions possible. They've been a great addition to the podcast. Chad and Shannon are two diehard Florida State fans who are active and very eager to help out anybody within the community, and they've been able to be great partners for us, and we would encourage any of our listeners to keep them in mind if they're in the process of going through a home mortgage, or we'll actually kind of broaden the conversation for some of the services that they're able to offer in time, but for now, we'll just stick with those that are needing a home loan.
Absolutely, man. If you guys need a home loan, 844-FSU-LOAN or FSUHomeLoans.com. 844-FSU-LOAN, FSUHomeLoans.com. Go see Chad and Shannon at Resolution Home Loans. You get hooked up right with Shannon. He's Chad's number one loan guy in the state. We've already had a couple listeners have successful processes with them, and we're looking forward to continuing that relationship with many more. So let's jump into our buy or sell, man.
So the first one is buy or sell. Florida State scores more than 40 points on a conference opponent more than twice this season. Were you the one who added the historical reference here?
No, actually, that was
from Devin. Devin, nice that job. Is strong. Very strong. Yep. 0 times this occurred in 2017, twice in 2016. Yeah. Did they do that against BC? I'm trying to remember.
2 years ago?
Well, no.
Yeah, 2 years ago was the BC game where it was like, basically, if Harold Landry didn't sack McGuire, then Florida State scored.
Mm, right.
Like, Brock Rubel got destroyed, but if on the, like, the, he only had like 11 sacks. So, like, on the 50 other plays, Florida State was just destroying him. So, I'm going to buy this all day. This one is an easy one to me. I mean, you play Syracuse, you play Wake Forest, you play, and BC will be a little bit tougher, but I definitely think that you'll also have a shootout or two.
Yeah, I was going to say, you'll put 40. I don't know that you necessarily have to, and you're right to do so, but I don't know that you necessarily have to look at the bottom feeders of the conference to find teams that Florida State could put 40 on this year. I think that's a pretty safe bet, and I would eagerly take the two, and I'd be pretty tempted to take three.
All right, Devin has another question, by the way, Ingram. He says, you keep saying FSU will lose 3 or 4 games this year. What games do you think those will be? I feel like Clemson, Notre Dame, and Miami are the most reasonable. Maybe Virginia Tech will be a fourth most likely loss. A trip to Raleigh is always a scary thing, too, so that's 5 that he's not super comfortable with. The rest of the games I feel are very winnable, and we'd be disappointed to see a loss. If they go 2 and 3 in the 5 you listed, there's your 3. They could also lose a bowl game, but if we're talking about regular season, Florida's not a slam dunk win. I would pick Florida State to win that game. You also have to go on the road to play at Louisville, which loses Lamar, but the defense should be better, and I think they'll be a little bit better than people think because they weren't just Lamar, but I would take Florida State in that game in a vacuum. If you figure that Florida State will be underdogs at Clemson, Notre Dame, and Miami, let's say you go 1 and 2 in those 3, right? I don't think it's reasonable to think you're going to go 9-0 in your other games. You see what I'm saying? Like as a fan, as an FSU fan, if you're going to pick Florida State to pull an upset, then you should probably also be open to picking them to be upset by a team or two. So the easier thing on here is look at the schedule. Who are your locks on the schedule? Like teams you're just very sure, or games you're very sure FSU will beat. Va-Tech, not a lock. Samford, that's a lock to me. At Syracuse, I think it's a lock. Northern Illinois, I think that's a lock too. So I would be shocked if Florida State starts anything other than 4-0 or 3-1. Personally, I don't think you're going to lose any of those 3. Va-Tech to me is, you know, up in the air, but at the same time, like I do think you'll be favored, and I like FSU's chances there. Especially because they lost Jermaine Edmonds, who is, we were watching his highlights tonight. We spoke about that guy on the podcast before, man. That dude's a freak. It's good for him to not be on that team anymore.
Didn't break my heart to not have to play him first week of September this year. No, not at all.
Is that Louisville a lock for you? It's the week before you go to Miami.
Yeah, I mean, I feel more comfortable with that game, but I'd have a hard time putting it as a lock.
So Louisville, I agree, is not a lock. It's a game you'll be favored in, but it's not a lock. There's going to be some growing pains with this new system, right? This is a drastically different system than the one you're running. It is simpler, but it is also different. Miami, certainly not a lock. Wake Forest in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
This is kind of the ones that I do think I'm closer to making it a lock than other people.
I personally think that's it. I mean, at Boston College, you should beat Boston College, particularly at home. But
it's in Tallahassee.
They're going to be decent. That's also, you're coming back from playing Notre Dame at a night game the week before. Now, 7 days is 7 days, so I'm not going to tell you that playing at night is going to be all that tougher than anything else. But that'll be a big game. That'll be a big atmosphere. That's more what I was talking about rather than body clock. But it's wedged between Notre Dame and Florida, and that's I would certainly feel comfortable about that game, but I'm not sure I'd push that completely into lock category either.
So to me, and this is we're recording this on April 26th. If you go 8-4 or 9-3, to me that's meeting expectations on the season. If you go 10-2 or better, and I really don't see a real realistic path for you to go like 11-1, 12-0, but can't say it can happen. If you go 10-2 or better, that's really exceeding expectations. If you go 7-5 or worse, then you really need to start looking at, like, was there a ridiculous amount of injuries or something like that? You know what I mean? Especially if it's, like, worse than 7-5. 7-5, you could easily get with a couple bad bounces and some bad luck. If you're 6-6 or worse, that's really a failure, barring, like, just everybody on the team going down with injury or something like that. So that's kind of where I think losses could come from for this team. We usually see the jump with new head coaches in year two. We talked about last episode, and guys, do go back and listen to prior episodes if you want. Give us those 5-star ratings, as we always appreciate those. Ingram, about separating like hype and promise for the long-term future of the program, first season expectations. And there really does have to be a separation, because if you let one affect the other too much, that's not a good thing. And they're really not that related.
Yeah, there needs to be a clear delineation there. And they're not necessarily tied together. Now, would it be better for the program to have a nicer year? Would maybe you can make an argument that they'll have a better recruiting class, certainly. But as far as the immediate correlation, I would separate those two things. And like you said, I would point people back to our last podcast for a little more broader conversation about that exact point.
Vishal asks, what type of defense will give the Gulf Coast offense problems, and which teams do we play which will best be able to execute the said defense? Ingram, I think you have one defense in mind who might get this team's trouble this year.
I mean, I have an idea that if you give me some of the pieces Clemson has, I might be able to form a defense that'll give Florida State some troubles. But yeah, I mean, besides three of the better defensive linemen in the country, I would say teams with depth, teams that have guys that are long and can have some multiplicity to their game, guys that are you're going to need a lot of athletes, and you're going to need a little bit of a healthy rotation to counter what you see out of this offense.
Essentially, it's just math. I think the teams that will give this offense trouble are largely teams that would give some other offenses trouble. I think if you can win up front with four defensive linemen against five blockers consistently, then you're going to give this offense some trouble. And that's really against any offense, because then you're able to drop, because you only have 11 players on the field, right? So if your four are beating their five, then your four are going to beat their five. And your seven in the back can drop into coverage against their five. They're going to sit out in pass routes. So if you win 4-on-5, you're definitely going to win 7-on-5. Clemson can do that. I'm not sure Miami can do that. They did lose both their T-tackles up front, and that's going to be an area of concern. We'll see. The other way you could give this defense trouble, if you want to blitz, give this offense trouble, is if you want to blitz a lot and you have really, really stud defensive backs and Florida State's receivers don't make any plays. I don't see a lot of teams on the schedule like that this year. I think Florida has two good starting corners for sure in Henderson and Wilson. I don't know they have the 3 and 4 of those guys. I don't know that their linebackers are good enough to cover DJ if he's in the slot. I don't think there's necessarily like a specific answer of like, hey, if they run this coverage and this, you know, this type of thing, it'll give this offense trouble. You know, it may just be there's not enough tape on it necessarily. But in terms of, you go back and you look at like what Art was doing at Baylor, and the run game here is different, but the passing stuff is similar. There wasn't like some scheme anybody in the Big 12 came up with to stop them. Occasionally they would run up like against a team with better athletes, a lot better athletes, and they would get beat. But I think if I was playing this offense this year, you know, I would probably see if I could test the, I guess I would try to stop the run while playing a two deep shell. And that's much easier said than done. I don't think most teams on the schedule can do that, but I do think Clemson can do that, and we'll probably do it really successfully. I think they'll. I don't like how Florida State matches up with Clemson this year at all. So that's my answer for sure. Is for this year, Clemson.
Buy or sell? Florida State having a better offense than what Oregon had last year. Oregon in 2017 was 32nd in S&P offense and averaged 36 points per game.
I'm gonna buy. At least in terms of the S&P. Now, Florida State's going to play a tougher slate of defenses this year than Oregon faced last year. So that's certainly something to consider as far as the points per game. But I think even that will be close or potentially over. But the number 32 S&P offense, I think Florida State will be better than that. You got to keep in mind, Oregon had their quarterback missing last year for about six of their games. So I don't think this one's going to be all that close.
Yep. Put me down for a buy as well on this one. Back to the more traditional question here. This is, we knew that Jimbo liked fat in his steak and wouldn't trim the fat when always necessary. And we know Saban, being the standard of college football, cuts kids and fakes injuries to keep the roster lean. What's your thoughts on how Willie will fare in this area?
Well, I think that initially they are definitely going to have some trimming of the fat. That's just something that all new coaches do. What I don't know is how he will handle it 3, 4, 5 years down the road, because he really hasn't been at a program for more than 4 years. So I think I have an incomplete answer on this one. But I do expect more roster attrition before the year starts, for sure. I think there'll be some guys who are just not going to get with the program and will have to be, they'll have to find another program to get with. But like long term, I guess we'll just have to see. You know, hopefully you're recruiting guys who want to be here and who are going to be good fits, but nobody does that perfectly. You know, this is the thing. We know the offseason program right now is really hard. Is it going to be as hard in 4 or 5 years, assuming Taggart's still here? If it is, then you'll probably have some similar attrition rates, because there'll be some guys who decide that, hey, we've talked about this a long time, Ingram. Like, do you love playing football, or do you love what being in Tallahassee and saying I play for FSU gets you? The latter is what they want less of in the program. Mm-hmm. So that's just something to keep an eye on there. Well, we are almost done with the first round of the draft, man.
I mean, the Ravens just took a 25-year-old tight end. I'm a little taken back by that.
Oh, the South Carolina kid is pretty good.
Yeah, oh, he's good as hell. I'm just a little surprised by that. But yeah, good for him. First round. All right.
This guy is jacked. Like he really should consider pro wrestling, and he's got the hair for it too. If football doesn't work out,
let's see. The next question is: given our lack of talent and depth at linebacker, the loss of so many other defensive players to the pros, and the resulting likely step back for the defense in 2018, should Florida State slow down the Gulf Coast offense a bit? We once snapped the ball with 33 seconds on the play clock in the spring game. Is that what we should expect come fall? Or will snaps occur with, say, 20 seconds left be more typical? To be clear, I don't mean to suggest a return to Jimbo Fisher's glacial pace. Is the spring game pace sustainable and typical, or will it slow down a bit? Maybe more importantly, should it slow down a bit, or would that be harming our best defense, which could very well end up being our offense?
Good question here.
Good nuanced question here, Tripp. Absolutely.
I'm going to introduce a term here. Protect your defense with points. Protect your defense with points. Score points. That way, if your defense is tired and makes a mistake, maybe the mistake doesn't kill you because maybe you're up by a couple scores. I totally understand what the question's asking. This year, my answer is a flat-out no. You are trying to establish your identity as a program, not just a team. I think Taggart is smart enough to realize they're not going to win anything this year as far as like overall prizes, most likely. He wants to set the tone and set the tempo for what Florida State is going to be as a program. They're not going to ease into this. They're going to go pedal to the metal. That's what they do.
Protect your defensive points. I like that. It's also heck of a lot easier to situationally dictate to an opponent if you're up by 10 points, 14 points, or anything else. So I would expect, I don't know that you'll see too many plays with 33 seconds left on the clock, but I don't think you're going to see a huge variation from the pace that was displayed in spring. I think that was intentional. I think that's what they want. And I fully expect a pretty aggressive offense as far as what it tries to do with tempo.
Absolutely. And you know, I don't know that Florida State's linebacker depth is that bad. I just don't think it has a lot of talent. You know what I mean? Like they've got bodies. They just don't necessarily have good bodies. Question here about penalties, Inger. You see this one? Matt asks, my question is about penalties. A quick look at penalty stats for the last year for Oregon and FSU is initially concerning, as Oregon racked up a whopping 122 penalties for negative 1,148 yards over 13 games, to FSU 78 penalties for 699 yards over 14 games, including Southern Miss. That can't be true. Florida State did not play 14 games. They played 13 because they didn't play for a conference championship, right? Am I missing something there? There's no way, right? They played 13.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. This might be explained away by the differences in tempo, personnel, and or players, but I'm interested to hear your take on what we might expect to see with regard to penalties with this new staff, strategy, and team. If the differences are or will be significant, and what should we be concerned about, if anything? Finally, a quick shout-out to Union Pub and Patty Berry's Pub, who graciously host game-watching events for FSU Sports in conjunction with the Seminole Club of Greater Washington, D.C., the official FSU alumni chapter in the D.C. area. Oh, cool. Hashtag D.C. Knowles. Hashtag Doak in D.C. All right, so I have not looked into this penalty thing as much as I wanted to. I was doing some other things like the receiver alignment and the tempo stories this spring. However, I will tell you that is certainly that's a disparity. It's also a one-year thing. I would want to know what are Florida State's penalties like that, or excuse me, penalties like in previous years. So I'm going to look that up. In 2016, Florida State had 100 penalties, which is, how many did Oregon have, Inger?
122.
All right, for 1,148 yards. So 100 instead of 78. That's a lot less discrepancy. In 15, they had 89. 2014, they had 88. In 2013, they had 79. 2012, they had 89. 2011, they had 103. 2010, they had 88. So I think if you look at Florida State's seasons under Jimbo, they're probably averaging, 85, 90, roughly? And if you look at Oregon, 122 is a lot of penalties for sure. I really would want to see a breakdown of what those penalties were. And I also want to figure just the tempo on this thing. On a percentage basis, let's say, I don't know, 122 divided by 85 is like 43% more. How many more plays is FSU going to run, right? If they go from 60 plays to 85 plays a game, well, guess what? That accounts for the disparity in terms of number of plays, number of penalties entirely. So I do think that just my, back of the napkin math here, the vast majority of that is going to be just because you're running a lot more plays in your games. On a per play basis, I don't think that the penalty rates are that much higher. I'll look into that a little more, but just looking at this and looking at the increase in tempo that I expect, I don't think it's going to be a massive uptick in penalties per play, which is with the way football is going, you really need to look at per play metrics and per drive metrics, because that takes tempo and normalizes your stats, as opposed to letting them be inflated or deflated with an aggressive or kind of timid tempo. Do we need to sneak under buy or sell in here?
All right, bud. I'm not sure exactly how we would wrap this into a buy or sell. Why don't we split the difference and say 183 pounds here. James Blackman enters the season at 183 pounds. Buy or sell?
So this all depends on what you think. Like, mm-hmm. I know we're being graded now. We actually have a podcast historian who tracks our buyer sales. I'm going to go ahead and buy just because I do feel like he's put on some weight. He doesn't look quite as skinny as he did last year. If you believe last year that he was at 180, then you're clearly buying. I think last year he was more like a buck 69. But in any case, I'm still going to buy. I'm going to go over on that 183.
Yeah, if you give me opening day roster weight or first day of practice or something like that, yeah, I'd definitely take that. I would. I think Blackman's never going to be somebody that carries a ton of weight, but wouldn't shock me to see him put on 6, 7, 8 pounds over the course of the season of real, over the course of the summer. I think kid will start to grow into his frame, and we'll always talk about the fact that he's a little bit slight compared to other quarterbacks. But I think this is one that I'll pretty confidently buy.
Do you want to go another buy or sell, or do you want to go another question?
Splice a question here. This is from David. David writes, I was recently thinking that back when I was looking at colleges in Florida and chose Florida State back in the 90s was when I really became enamored with the program and Coach Bowden. His success from the late 80s to the early 2000s is unprecedented, and as a fan base, we became somewhat spoiled with only one or two losses a season during that stretch. Was he really that good of a coach to be able to sustain that, or was Florida State simply at the right place, right time, recruiting-wise, being a hot program like Clemson is right now? A lot of things here. So the SEC has always been the SEC, but the SEC hadn't really leveraged all of its ability to be the juggernaut that it was. It was also a lot easier to go into some of these states and get kids, Louisiana in particular. Florida State was the it school in recruiting, I would say, from like 91 or 92 up until the year about 2000. So there was a real long window of them being pretty much the predominant program in the country when it came to recruiting at a national level. I'm always hesitant about this because you don't want to shortchange Bowden what he did. But when you look back on it, he was also, and look, you work real hard to create your luck. So I'm not going to call him lucky. You're certainly the beneficiary of and frequently create your own luck. But there was a convergence of events that was kind of friendly, creating the long sustaining success that Florida State had.
So it's both. And look, the all-time greats in almost any sport are both amazing, talent-wise, work ethic-wise, and also they get the right fit. Michael Jordan worked his butt off, crazy talented. Also went to an organization that, drafted well, and Phil Jackson, who was a really good coach with elite players. It's both, and it's okay to be both. Bowden came to Florida State at a time when the state population was absolutely exploding. Like the 80s, the state was growing like crazy. Think about how long air conditioning has been around,
it's the whole growth of the Sun Belt.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And especially in Florida, we're just so humid, I couldn't live down here if there wasn't AC, or I wouldn't. I'd probably die of mosquito-borne illness. It was both, man. Like, the state was growing at an incredibly rapid rate. You had not been a girls' school for a little while now at that point, relative to the arc of the university's history. And so it's absolutely both. And that's a great combination. And then that allows you to put together a dynasty like that. Second part of his question as well.
Yeah, I was going to say, I just found a second and third part of this question. So I apologize if I shortchanged you there by thinking, but the first paragraph was the question.
Fast forward to Jimbo's era, where he was not able to attain that level of consistency. I listened to some of your commentary articles about pace of play, fourth down percentage, offense being too complicated to get younger players on the field, and not being, quote, with the times in regards to pro/spread concepts, and it seems FSU was its worst or own worst enemy with regards to achieving that consistency and made it look really difficult, at times, an unwatchable product. Fast forward again to the Coach Willie Taggart era, where he hasn't won a game yet, but win share predictions are out for the year, and it seems to be a tad lower, maybe accurate given the schedule. But at the same time, also wonder how much the win share predictions are also based on recent history and diminished overall expectations due to style of program being run under Fisher versus what Taggart is trying to implement with the very high tempo and playing to the team's strength, which is that we have more talented depth than 90% of the schools we play. If Taggart can stop recent history on FSU shooting itself in the foot due to scheme and pace, do you guys think we can get back to the former type of consistent success that we as Seminoles became used to? No, I don't think that run that Bowden had is ever coming back, which is what makes it so special. Even if Jimbo hadn't had all the, you know, the personal stuff go wrong, that would have happened. And I don't think Taggart can do that. I just don't think anybody can do that right now in Tallahassee.
I'm not sure it's possible in the college football. I mean, unless you're in Tuscaloosa, unless you're doing what Nick's doing. Now, Clemson's had a nice window, but and I'm the first to throw an effusive amount of praise at Clemson, but they've done it for, what, 5 years now? This is not even that. I wouldn't start to quite put them in the same category. It's just a different day. Too many people with too much money really love college football, and as such, you still have like the concentration. College football's an oligarchy, certainly. You've got a decent amount of players out there. I don't know that you'll ever see, I shouldn't say ever because of what's going on in Alabama, but probably not at Florida State. And overall, to see something like that is exceptionally, exceptionally rare.
Yeah, like if the ACC network becomes something that actually like starts paying out, you know, maybe, but...
No, don't you worry about that ACC network. Oh, God. That thing's going to be a money tree like that nobody's seen before.
At some of the SEC schools, if you talk to some of these guys who were at Florida State and now they're, you know, elsewhere, they have a recruiting assistant and a quality control guy for every position. So, for instance, let's say a kid comes to, like a kid that you're recruiting at Bama goes and visits Miami and he tweets something about it. The recruiting assistant for that position is going to notify the position coach and the QC guy, like immediately, so they can go send him a graphic or a message and blow him up, make sure that the kid knows that they're thinking about him. At Florida State, they don't have that. They don't have the money for that. I don't think they have close to that. So just something interesting there to think about. That's not going to happen in Tallahassee. The Bowden times is not coming back. It's just not. It doesn't mean you can't win a national championship. It doesn't mean you can't have an elite level program because they, you know, they have one, and I think they're going to continue to be a high level program. If you want to put it together, like Saban's a much better coach than Bowden ever was, and he has better resources than Bowden did. So you're seeing the results of that, and it's still incredibly tough.
So I don't want to take that into like a negative. I certainly think there's things that are attainable. I think you could see a concentrated run for Taggart as far as a consistency of recruiting classes where, say, he's here for 6 years. It could be possible that you see him garner a couple number one overall classes, a couple classes that are in the top three. I don't see him necessarily ever falling out of top six or seven or something like that. Now, how that relates to the field, we'll have to see. But a long-winded way of I don't. You know, if you want to go back and look at some of those recruiting classes from, you know, like the 91 class and the 93 class, you basically had Florida State signing the number one or number two guy at every position in the class. And that's something that any school is going to struggle to concentrate that much talent.
It's crazy, man. I mean, it's just what they did was insane. Chris asks, we've heard a lot about Terry and DJ Matthews, but not much about the progress Gavin is making. Can you talk about whether he has made progress and what you might expect from him in the fall? Can we expect him to be a true number one, or is this a guy that doesn't show his full potential until he gets to the league, i.e. Cromartie or Bolden? I will tell you that the word we were getting out of camp were better than what he showed in the spring game, which I do believe. I think he's going to be a better player than what he showed in the spring game. Will he be a true number one this year? I don't know about that. Like, baby steps. You know, how about just be like a guy who can catch multiple balls in a season?
Be a consistent contributor. That's all that you need from him right now.
Exactly. So that's kind of what I got on that. What is the upside, downside, and ceiling you see with this new offense? By ceiling, I mean that I know when lesser talented teams who have been forced to run this have largely struggled when coming up against more physical and talented teams. FSU is one of the more talented teams, but I'm still concerned that this offense might be too simple and can't win a bunch of jump balls on Bama, Clemson, Ohio State, etc., which is who you have to beat to win your ultimate goals. Can you comment? Well, I will tell you, when Alabama has lost...
Yeah, it hasn't been because they got out-schemed. No.
Yeah, The last pro, I feel like we, for some of these questions we get this year, we really should just replay our summer episodes where we said Florida State's not going to beat Alabama because it doesn't do the things that gives Alabama trouble. It just doesn't. So that would be the old pro style offense. When Ole Miss was beating Alabama, they were having like Laquon Treadwell and those guys and Evan Engram go off and catch ridiculous jump balls. When Clemson was beating them, it was Mike Williams and who was the tight end they had who also killed FSU. They got him in one-on-one situations. They got Alabama out of position with tempo and they got those guys the ball and they trusted their athletes to win those balls. They weren't like scheming Alabama to death. You're probably not going to do that considering Bama is probably the reason why they're trying to put that rule in that there's only a certain number of guys on the sideline and in the box who can wear headsets. So you can't have, you know, like an army, like
three former defensive coordinators breaking down each level of the defense. Yeah.
If your coaching boxes look like you're having a telethon. Yeah. Exactly. Like they got the telethon going on during the game. You know, if you have enough assistants to watch every single player individually and send down like notes between each series, you're probably not going to get out schemed. Just a thought. The offense is definitely not too simple. Part of the thing here is that when you're going that fast, for the defense, it actually seems more complicated because you are having to reduce your level of complexity on defense because you can't get certain calls in. You can't make certain adjustments. You can't sub. So it becomes harder for the defense as well, even though there may be fewer concepts that you're running on the offensive side of the ball. I don't think this is like some sort of inferior scheme to what Fisher was running. They both have pluses and minuses. I think it will be a more consistent scheme, though, because I do think it's going to be easier to teach. We got some recruiting questions here, and then I think we will probably call it a night. All right. Yeah,
let's do that. Before we jump into this, Bud, let's just thank our friends at Madison Social For the Table Restaurant Group. I believe it was today, maybe it was yesterday, was National Pretzel Day. I will say, from firsthand experience during our meet and greet that we had before the spring game, ordered a pretzel at Township. Not just saying this because I've been able to work with him for 3 years. It was exceptional. I mean, great, great options there. I was blown away by the quality of food that I was able to have it other than just the flagship Mad Show. It was the first time I've been able to get down there in a while. But exceptional options across the board. And we'll particularly just remind people to keep something simple as a pretzel in mind. It was a fantastic little addition to the menu and just another example of just a consistent, high-quality item that they're able to do day in, day out.
That's right, man. They actually have a legit chef at Township. It's a great family restaurant. So they're the first major sponsor to jump on board with us. Everybody who came out, I think, had an awesome time and also a lot of people ordered the food and got it. It's definitely more than just a beer haul. I'm sad I had to miss National Pretzel Day. I've been following my Instagram. All the beer cheese they were making looked really, really good. So a really cool set of sponsors we have. And everybody, when you're in town in Tallahassee, visit Madso. Also, a lot of really cool Tallahassee and Florida State-related gear on their website. Just go to madsosocial.com. You'll see the gear link there up top. So. And by the way, our T-shirts, I think we'll be able to order those again coming up soon. So for all y'all who missed out, despite the fact we gave you a lot of advance warning, we will reopen the T-shirt ordering, I think, sometime soon. With that, let's get into the final run of questions for tonight. Man, we are going long again, but listeners demand it.
Good questions. Ron asks, do you think Florida State is in the running for top recruits now? More now than in the past decade. Not everyone is a fit for a program, but it seems as though Florida State is in the conversation more than before. Would you agree with my opinion?
Ron, not really. I think that, look, we're quick to say negative things about the areas of the program that we felt were negative under Jimbo, but I got to be honest, this is not one of them. I think that Florida State was routinely in it for programs all across the country. Now, maybe not as many kids from California, but they certainly had a lot of kids from the South who would come in and from Texas. You know, look at Marvin Wilson. Look at Mario Edwards Jr., who obviously, you know, is dead. But no, I don't think they're really in it for more kids now. But that wasn't an area that you really needed to improve And I don't know that you really can improve it, but it was an area that you wanted to try to stick to about as close as you could be. Because you know, if you can stick to that and you can improve potentially how well those kids play early on via a little bit simpler system, maybe via a system that's a little bit closer to what they're most of them are running in high school on the offensive side of the ball, well, then maybe that could be an improvement as far as year-to-year consistency. So I understand that a lot of people are kind of swept up in the excitement of the recruiting cycle right now. But no, I don't think they're like in it with more elite kids than they were before.
They might be in it with more elite kids than they were in the past like 15 months or something. But certainly not over the broader period of Fisher's tenure. And there's a lot of excitement and there's a lot of legitimate reason to be optimistic. As you said, recruiting was never the problem with Fisher, and there weren't but so many coaches out there, probably ones that you can count on one hand, that you wouldn't suffer a significant fall off when moving from Fisher to whatever next staff there is. So I think it's a situation where you can honestly be appreciative and recognize that both of these staffs do an exceptional job on the recruiting trail.
All right. And by the way, like we saw that was called going from Will Muschamp to Jim McElwain. Maurice has a question, man. My question centers around past recruiting classes. To me, it appears FSU usually lands premier prospects in the defensive secondary, defensive line, and at running back. However, it seems that recruiting at linebacker and offensive line positions have been somewhat lackluster over the past few years, with a few exceptions. Do you think there is or was an emphasis on recruiting certain positions versus others? No, I don't. I mean, certainly results were better at area, you know, some areas than others, but I definitely don't think that there was any intent in those results. I just think that some areas you did better than others. There definitely wasn't like an emphasis. They went out and they got, Dickerson and Josh Ball and Juwan Williams and, you know, a number of highly rated kids coming off the line, some of whom panned out and some didn't. And then, you know, they get Bavion Johnson, number one center in the country, hadn't been able to stay healthy so far. Linebacker, you know, similar thing. They've signed a number of highly rated guys, you know, some who flunked out, you know, drugged out or drug tested out or whatever. They have had some concentrated bad luck at those spots. They are definitely making a big time effort now to patch some of those spots. For instance, I saw that Greg Fry followed the number one offensive tackle in junior college in the country, who would be, if he were to come to Florida State, he would come and look. If you're FSU, I think you can just straight up tell this kid, if you come in here in shape, you're a day one starter. That's how good we think you are. That's also what we think of our tackle situation right now. I think you could do that with linebacker too. I think both those linebacker spots would be open if you land like a five-star linebacker type in this class. I don't think a lot of FSU's linebackers right now, you know, encouraged by Dontavius Jackson, but I can tell you for sure that the way FSU's recruiting the linebacker position right now, they are selling playing time. I had a parent tell me, hey, the way those guys talk about those linebackers, they must really suck. That's a parent of a linebacker.
A parent of a linebacker recruit.
Okay. Correct. You don't take four linebackers in a class if you think you're set there. You do it if you're worried about the guys you got on your roster. So they're trying to fix it, but I don't think that they were trying to not fix it. They were trying to not address it before.
There was no lack or certainly no intentional effort to not fill certain places on the roster. The linebacker one's a bit of a mystery to me. You're located in an area of the country. You're not going to have to travel too far to find good linebacker prospects. So I would expect them to be able to fill that. But, you know, for periods of time, Florida State is not – there was a concern in the 90s as well as they were recruiting during that period that they weren't always doing as well at linebacker as they should. Offensive linemen's the other part of the question that he mentioned. Just from a geographic standpoint, about the only thing that Florida doesn't produce routinely is elite offensive linemen and occasionally defensive tackles. So I can understand an extent there, but it'd be curious to see. I expect that Florida State will recruit well across the board. There'll always be areas where you either miss on a kid last minute or a kid that you get in fails out, and then you have, you know, situational depth bubbles. But as you mentioned, there is an aggressive attempt to fill some of the current vacancies when it comes to talent at the roster.
I will tell you, in 2020, there are two studs in the state who they're going to have a legitimate shot with. Braun and then Jalen Rivers are over there at Oak Leaf in Jacksonville are, in my opinion, like legit five stars. So it's not out of the question that Florida State could land 2 5-star offensive tackles in the 2020 class. 2019, like where they are in the country, it's a much better guard crop than it is a tackle crop, unfortunately, for FSU. So they're trying to have to try to cast that wide net and maybe land a junior college kid too if you can. Question here from David. We got 3 questions left, it looks like. In 2018, FSU signed 5 receivers, including one who you consider to reach. I understand that's a shortage of the position. This year, however, FSU is being selective with their receiver takes. They did take Goolsby. With the consensus saying they will take 2 to 3, it seems to me that FSU will end up passing on better receivers this year than they took in 2018. Is this a fair statement? What are your thoughts? This is a case where, in hindsight, the staff might consider taking 5 last year a small mistake. Thanks, Dave. Let me see. So there's 3 questions here. Is it a fair statement that they might end up passing on a better receiver this year because they took so many last year? Yes. What are your thoughts? And is it a case where they will regret it? No, I don't think they're going to regret it because you have to consider, I'll gladly pay you tomorrow for a hamburger today, right? The kids you could get this year, there might be like one better than you could have gotten last year. However, those kids don't get to your program until the fall of 2019. You have a need for receivers on the roster right now. You're looking at the receivers on your roster, assuming everybody qualifies. Naquan's going to be gone. You know, can you count on Campbell and Gavin being here in 2019? I don't know. DJ Matthews would then be your most experienced receiver in 2019. You get Tamari and Terry, who's, you know, about equally experienced. Pookie Wilson, Ontario Wilson, they moved over, converted corner. Jordan Young, Trayshawn Harrison, DeMarcus Adams, Warren Thompson, and Keyshawn Helton. You really needed to get the depth here built up. So I understand them wanting to take a kid last year, even if he's a little bit lesser prospect, to get him in for depth purposes, even if it meant passing on somebody, because you're running the spread offense. You can't go, like, let's say Campbell and Gavin both left, right? You can't go into 2019 with Matthews, Terry, Young, Harrison, Adams, and one more, I don't think. I mean, that's like 7 or 8 guys. That's not what you really want. That'd be 2 years in a row where you have kind of questionable numbers and questionable experience. So I actually don't have a big problem with it. I understand the gist of the question, but you do have to understand the value of getting a kid on your campus now as opposed to waiting to next year. I also don't think they knew how good Pookie Wilson was going to be at receiver. In fact, I know they didn't because they hadn't moved him over yet. So if there's any regret, it's like, man, we took 5, but then all of a sudden we didn't know we had this corner we could flip to receiver.
All right, so let's see here. One of our final questions will be from Scott. And Scott asks, I know you have a better statistical references available to you than I, so I kind of quit trying to do the research, but my thought was this. From what I recall, those Baylor defenses during the years when the offense was putting up all those ridiculous numbers were horrendous, also giving up their fair share of 30, 40, 50-point games. I get with an up-tempo offense, the opposing offense will be on the field more, but with Florida State's history of defensive dominance, do you see a decline in the ability to recruit those studs compared to what Florida State's been able to attract in the past?
Not at all. All the guys that Clemson has right now were recruited when they were playing at a blistering pace. Baylor's ability to recruit on defense is not at all analogous to what Florida State can do, not in terms of facilities, tradition, none of that. The only similarities are how far wide the receivers line up and how fast they go. That's where it begins and ends, really. I'll tell you this, Oklahoma is doing a really good job recruiting defensively right now, especially with some DBs. And one of their pitches is, you're going to get so many more snaps to make an impact and to show your skills. And if you're a young guy, we're going to need you. You know why? Mm-hmm. So our defense is going to have to defend 75, 80 plays a game. Look at this. You know, this is something that's important for us. You know, we're going to need you. Like, it's not just like a luxury. We need that. So, no, I don't think it's going to impact their ability to recruit on defense at all.
Heard it mentioned, this is our final question of the night, but it is heard it mentioned several times that the 2019 class for quarterbacks is not as strong as last year's. What are some of the stronger position groups for 2019, and what are some of the weaker ones?
So, quarterback is way down for sure.
2018 was a historically good class. I mean, that's something correct. You may see every 6, 7, 8 years.
Correct.
That's by no means the norm.
Hell, you know, yeah, if that. But it's also definitely down compared to a normal year, based on what we've seen so far. It's just not that good. For instance, I think in a normal year, Florida State would be able to get a Fomicon or a Howell and a Fomicon. But this year, because there's no like super elite kids, both those guys see their ratings a little bit inflated. You know what I mean? Because like, you got to have somebody rated number 3. You got to have somebody rated number 4. So they become higher profile. And so you can't get both those guys in the same class. Let me see. Who do I like this year? I think it's a very nice guard year, certainly. It's actually a back-to-back nice guard year. We had a good guard year last year. I think we have a very nice guard year this year. I think it's a pretty strong corner year so far. Not quite as good as last year, but I think it is pretty good. It does appear to be a nice linebacker year. I like Brandon Smith. I like Owen Popoe. There's a lot of guys who can really run and hit. Defensive end-wise, I think it's pretty nice. I want to see some more of these guys, some of these elite camps, but I think it's solid, man. Running back, we'll see. I like Trey Sanders a lot. After him, you know, Jerry Neely might, like, I think he got rated as the number 3 baseball prospect in the country at one point. So I'm not sure if he's going to pass up baseball money to go play football. I guess we'll wait and see on the running back. But and offensive tackle. I think it's a pretty good year for offensive tackle. So you're seeing FSU cast a really wide net there. They have playing time to sell. There's just not a lot of guys in the state of Florida who are on that level, which is why I think you're starting to see them look harder at Evan Neal as a tackle who visited for the spring game. Florida State made a really good impression.
Fair enough, man. I think that's a decent little recap of the questions that we had submitted. A decent blend of kind of a final look back at spring and give our listeners an idea as to kind of how both the staff and roster leave spring and what's expected of them over the summer. And as always, we'll try our best to keep you guys informed with what's going on the recruiting trail. So unless, Bud, you have anything else to add, I think that's a another solid episode in the books.
No, man, it's been good. 5 stars on iTunes, thenolcast@gmail.com. If you have a long question, short questions are good too. We always take buyer sells as well. And until next time, I think this is our 20th or 21st episode of the year. So really on pace. We in the off season, when ball's not actually being played, we try to average about 1 every 7 days. And like right now we're at like 1 every 5. So, you know, if we could do like 3 episodes over the next 4 weeks, I think we'll be pretty happy with that. We'll be right back.